critics and theorists. Welcome to Critique of the Podcast Form, a critical theory podcast. You're joining us for episode 10. Today, we're talking about Ernst Bloch's 1932 text, Non-Synchronism and the Obligation to its Dialectics, first published in Heritage of Our Times. We will cover fascist ecstasy, colonial regimes, and the need to abolish the urban-rural divide. Before we dive right in, I want to introduce my co-host, Esther.
Hello, I'm Esther. I am also one of the editors at the Critical Theory Working Group, and I'm excited to be talking and asking questions about Bloch's amazing text, which actually seems very premonitory of our actualities of the time. I was very interested as well on how the synchronicity and parallel simultaneous different actualities could be found together in and now in a present, and how those obviously appear to have been very key into making fascism possible, but also of how those same breakings and chiasms of temporality could make a new condition of possibility for communism.
My name is Sebastian. I'm also on the editorial board of the Critical Theory Working Group. And before we go into the text, I briefly want to introduce the biography of Ernst Bloch. Now, Bloch was born in 1885 in Germany and completed his education surrounded by figures such as Simmel, Weber, and Georg Lukács. After the consolidation of fascist power in Germany, Bloch was forced to flee to Zurich, Switzerland, in 1933, where he completed the fragmentary Heritage of Our Times, known best for the earlier Spirit of Utopia and the later Principle of Hope. Bloch also drew on figures such as Thomas Münzer, and Bloch identified himself very explicitly as a Marxist, whose work in today's history of critical theory often puts him in the periphery of what some would call the Frankfurt School of early critical theory. Now, I would like to know from you, Esther, how you first came across the works of Ernst Bloch.
Well, actually, the history, the very personal history of finding Bloch has to do with the times I was studying in CSM in London. And I went to a seminar led by CRMEP, so it's like the Center for Research of Contemporary European Philosophy. And they actually had this amazing seminar on hope and Ernst Bloch. And I was really interested. I thought it was very inspiring. Obviously, that was like around 2013. And for some of us, as people from Spain, who had always lived in the temporality of the people who never stopped being on, you know, structures and also a great amount of people who never stopped being fascist, I found what was sight at the moment and everything like really appealing. Then when I was writing for my dissertation, I used his work on the principle of hope and the concepts of the not yet and the not longer. I have to confess that for the last times I've been involved in reading, as I am a slow reader, other authors. So I have now the chance to go back to block and to retrieve, perhaps not exactly what he's talking about in the principle of hope, but other concepts that I find complementary, albeit perhaps at some moments dialectically slightly opposed, which I hope we can discuss.
For me, I think I came across Bloch because I found his book on Marx at the flea market.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself very astonished. Not only because Bloch was able to identify himself so explicitly as a Marxist. He was a very close reader of Marx's works. I was particularly drawn to his approach towards time in general. There's a bit where he talks about the line in the Communist Manifesto that under capitalist rule, the past dictates over the present, whereas communism should be understood as the dictatorship over the present, as the present, the dictatorship of the present over the past. And this, I think, is also something that we can discuss in today's investigation into this text. Something that stood out for me very much is the structure of the text. We recently discussed the works of Ghassan Kanafani, including his 1933 to 1936 Arab Revolution in Palestine, where he introduces these different classes, these different social actors, and how they contributed to the failure and also the successes of the partial revolution. And what was fascinating to me that this move in terms of writing, I was also able to discover in the text by Ernst Bloch. He talks about the youth as an actor. He specifically talks about the bourgeois youth, the rich kids, as figures of society who have a very sort of useless function, actually, which makes them particularly drawn to the ecstatic, the mythical elements of fascism. He also talks about the peasantry. He talks about the middle class and the white collar workers. So really what was a very pleasant experience for me was like looking at this text and recognizing this dramaturgical move of like almost painting a scene like a stage and introducing all the different actors. And I think this has a lot to do with what he says in terms of content in the text, with non-synchronicity, because he is forced also as an author then to present the different temporalities next to one another. They overlap externally. He says that they overlap in the now. They're externally there, but he does not proceed by historical events, for example. He actually himself like goes into different spaces in the past, different niches, different narratives, and lays them out next to one another and shows how they interact in conversation as part of a fascist movement. So this was definitely something that resonated with me a lot, this literary move to show how history is being contested by multiple temporalities at the same time.
It's interesting because while you were saying this, I just came up with these visions of the most amazing Baroque painters, like this guy from Spain who was called Valdés Leal, who painted absolutely everything inside there, every painting he made, including dead popes, but also the flies and fruit and, you know, the, sort of like the vanitas that had all these different temporalities as well, that is very rich. But yes, I think the image you bring in is very good to actually see a theory of time and a theory of this cohabitation of time and how the past, but also the suppressed past, the forgotten past, the latent past, maybe even the reptilian past, you know, he touches upon some anthropological moments as well, are alive between us. And they can be triggered depending of who is managing, no? the message. And so in a sense, we have in ourselves all those temporalities and also all those varieties of things, because I think, and I think he also describes that, not just because we happen to be together at the same actuality while having different, for example, ages. So one is young, the other is, you know, middle-aged, the other is very old, and so on, no? And so on. But also, because also in our own constitution as individuals, we inherit or we have ramifications of ancestries that perhaps once are peasants, once are more urban, once are more well-off, once are proletarians, once are immigrants. Perhaps I'm talking about myself, but I know there's a lot of people out there who is not just a very uniform, which there are people like that there are very uniform series of kind of generations repeating each other, repeating, no, the reproduction of their own class, no? Obviously. But I think it's true that the modern cities had a lot of people, like, in a sense, embodying or carrying with them these ancestors as well, which can also be fighting inside them, sorry, as calls for different aspects. I was also very interested about the issue about youth. And the youth that is void or devoid of activity, because obviously it's not been exploited or, you know, enslaved by a proletarization that makes them be so occupied and exhausted that they will not be even having time to think about the, you know, the arrow and the bow that he mentioned something about, you know, the dreams of bringing up the arrow and the bow. And becoming that sort of young, yes, the proto-young soldier. No? There's a moment in the text that I do think that he do understand that also the imagination of this group could be seduced or captivated by the call of the left. One of the aspects of his text, which I really like as well, where he talks, in a sense, of something that at the moment is pretty much talked about in certain circles in the left, at least the ones I follow from Spain, which is that the ideological aspect of the cultural war has to be fought by the people in the left, and that the left perhaps suffers from certain tendencies to mechanicism, which I found as well quite interesting, because it's as if what Bloch was trying to convey in those times appears as a necessity at the moment, that to be really thoroughly thought and be a part of our own self-critique.
Yeah, it's also really interesting what you, like, I think it makes sense that you point right away to how he talks about the possibility for the left to intervene. A sentence that particularly stood out to me was the little man, for instance, has lost money and wants to have it back. While seeking this, he can become like a brute and a dream. He is on the wrong track mentally, but still in the now. If his situation improves, the dreamy and brutal aspects will end in any case. If it does not improve, and if Hitler once in power is disappointing, then the proletarians who went along with him, or just gave him a try, will jump off to the left anyway, where they are expected. However, the petty bourgeois will at least no longer believe in ghosts. And so I think what he really tries to explain with this text is also that, you know, all these different classes respond differently to the situation of fascism. There's the different classes have their own, bring their own temporalities with them, but only through these temporalities, through that interaction with the fascist movement, they constitute themselves as actors in the first place. So he says very early in the text that now it's not anymore the proletariat and the bourgeois class that are in debate with one another. There's other actors entering the scene. There's other classes who force themselves on the scene to become part of the conversation. And it's, yeah, what also stood out to me in that, in this part on page 28 in my document is also how he continues to talk about the St. Vitus dance. And before I want to ask you about the St. Vitus dance, I think what he really tries to do here is to make an argument that there is not only this, you know, universal desire to dive into the ecstatic, the aggressive, the unleashed violence of fascism. There's also an attachment by the petit bourgeois class to like a desire for rationalism, a desire for imposing peace, a desire for a non-warlike situation. So there's also always this tendency that continues to survive amongst the petty bourgeoisie to just return to a false state of peace. I mean, we're very familiar with this, but it's, to me, it's very interesting that he brought this out, and he says they would rather withdraw, they would rather return to the drawing room today than wait till tomorrow. They're sound, they're refusing to engage in this aggressive, unleashed spectacle of the St. Vitus dance. And so now, of course, I would be interested in hearing from you, like, what does the Saint Vitus dance, in your opinion, do for him? Because it appears at multiple times, at multiple places in the essay.
Well, I think, obviously, there's the aspect of the Saint Vitus dance as sort of like an imaginary of the sort of more Nietzschean, Dionysian, all together naked of the kind of like what were called the you know, the Nazi young people who went to the woods and did kind of like naturalistic stuff or also esoteric stuff together. And so that it will be a sort of like critique of capacity to doing that or to immerse themselves in a sort of like ritualistic thing that is a distraction or evasion by it in itself, just by being, you know, in a celebratory kind of like mood, but that gives a space for violence to come after that moment of suspension and evasion. So that would be one aspect. But then later in his text, that comes like in page, I'm using the Weimar one, the 115 and the 116. Is quite interesting because he mentions Hegel and he mentions the sort of thing where he says Hegel's dialectical totality was still a mere one of remembered knowledge, a monadic one as well, in which admittedly no term was not drunk. So that's the famous Bacchanalian revel. But the thing with Hegel's Bacchanalian revel that then he actually includes in a bit, I will quote, has to, that's also can be taken both ways, but has this notion of keeping the capacity of judgment in the moment when everybody reposes. In the moment of repose, there's the moment of reflection, and is the moment of recollection, which again can have a lot of interpretations. But I think the way he used that, so he continues the his paragraph about talking about what sort of truth forms totality, and the sort of like the contradictions of all individual contradictions and the individual reconciliations. And he mentioned Shelley in there, the unity of the contradictions, and or the unity of the unity and the contradictions. But then he says, if the Hegelian truth of the final stage is to be taken seriously along with the self, which has to penetrate and to digest this whole wealth of systems, then the penetration can be only a non-contemplative one. So that's interesting because it's practice or activity, or one which possesses the wealth of the substance not in yielding past, but in the actual inheritance of its end in the now. In short, which gains additional revolutionary force precisely from the incomplete wealth of the past, when it is less than ever resolved at the final stage. And then he goes a little bit further, but it's just finished more or less with a multi-voice dialectic, as a dialectic of the contradictions collected today more than ever, has at any rate, even in capitalism, enough questions and contents which have not yet overtaken by the course of economic development. And the proletarian voice of the contemporaneous dialectic firmly remains the leading one. Yet beneath and above this cantus firmus, there run disordered exuberance which have to be referred to the cantus firmus only to the fact that the later, in critical and non-contemplative totality, refers to them. And then mentions also a very interesting notion of the multispatial dialectic. I am interested in this aspect of digesting.
You just mentioned digesting, right? And he has this towards the very beginning of the text, the first couple sentences of section B, where he talks about the youth. And he said, for the most part, youth turns away from the day that it has. It is a day that the young do not have today. But their dreams do not come only from an empty stomach. They are nourished just as materially by an empty condition of being young, which is not of the present. And so there's two things that stand out to me here. One, he's just again saying what all of our favorite Marxist dialecticians are saying, which is that the desire to fight for communism, of course, does not only come from the needs of bread. You know, we can put it in terms like bread and roses, food and culture, you know, but there's what Bloch, I think, emphasizes here is that it's about excavating a future. It's the dreams of the future that are as important to the hardworking blue-collar male proletarians, you know, like this. I think there's Marxist revisionists like to paint this picture of the proletarians as being very, like, you know, everyday minded, just very straightforward, like food or no food, sort of. And I mean, you know, not to get distracted by stupid discourses, but I think Bloch is one author who I find to have a particularly thought out defense of why the dreamy, the mythical, the mystical, the religious, why the messianic, why there is as much of relevance to understanding how classes move in specific social arrangements as the need to not go hungry. And here he talks about the youth, right? And he says that the youth is very, very oriented towards the future. Youths of bourgeois origins, but without any bourgeois prospects, invariably go to the right where they are promised a future. So it's not only about the reconstruction of a specific past. It's not only about, you know, the right giving, like explaining the past to you, you know, in a way that appeals to you. It's also about, fascism has a future, fascism has an image of the future. fascism has its own utopian images, so to speak. And yeah, I wanted to ask you if you have any thoughts of this, any thoughts on this sort of strategy of fascists to appeal to certain images of the past. When we talked yesterday, you mentioned the Reconquista as being a very important referent in Spanish fascist discourses.
I think one of the things that Locke also mentioned, and I am sorry, I cannot remember in which page, but he mentions this thing about the middle class, the sort of D class, middle class, impoverished subject that is very angry at democracy, because in a sense, for his own capacity, very limited capacity to judge the phenomenology of democracy, is thinking that it is the fault of democracy that the present is so unbearable. And imagine better past. And in the case of the Spaniards, and of, I think, a lot of people who, even if themselves are not aristocratic, they tend to identify just because of a tradition, just because you were, I don't know, given those tales, the famous tales they give to you, at least they were given to me that I grew up in fascism with Franco, like they give to you all these tales of castles, princesses, prince, the test in the woods, heroes. I mean, it really is like one very interesting reading of Cervantes' Don Quixote and some of his novels, but obviously Don Quixote, is the whole thing that Cervantes is already making a critique of that turn of paradigm a little bit in, like Chester with Hamlet, but the difference says, which is like, look at this guy, he still believes in the knight principles, in the feudal order, and he has fully forgotten that we are in the Baroque, we are in the pre-capitalist, but for some people that's already modernity, of course. The Americas have already started to be, exploited and colonized. And there's this desynchronicity. So it's already like Don Quixote is an example of that, And it's written in a humoristic critique key. But will Don Quixote represent a bastard? Like looking for, those principles, those old principles. And that's the problem with the whole thing, that the whole thing that fascism managed to sell is a sort of restoration. And that's why as well some monarchies had activated the fascist when they were like losing to, let's say, the more abstract developments of capital inside democracies. So that there were all these forces and alliances, as it happens with the early fascists in France, in Italy. I'm not so sure about the whole connection between the Germans and the Nazis, but I do think there was a sort of kind of commonality. But there is a sort of like, in a sense for them, it's a sort of paradise lost to modernity. And then obviously the proletarian, who is already someone who gets completely subsumed or trapped or in shackles by the present, doesn't have any nostalgia to go back to. It can only go forward. It can only go to liberation. It can only have imaginaries of new areas, no? Like if you think about the Haitian revolution, no? It's like going forward. Or if you think about what the people, like all the Maroons in the Caribbean islands, when they start to find that they could escape to some areas in the mountains, for example, and generate their own communities, that was also creativity and invention of breaking free. And it's actually quite scary if you think about it, that in general, those who have something to remember as something lost appear to be something that, in a way or another, are going to be conservative. One of my questions, though, and we mentioned this a little bit yesterday, was that when you have the memory, the archive of the previous revolutions, when you have the memory of that which was achieved shortly, you also gain a memory. You also gain a history, a genealogy to which you can adhere and miss and fight for from the left side. So,
yeah, what we both realized was that there's some parallels between Bloch and the Lebanese communist Mahdi Amel, apropos the notion of cultural heritage. I mean, it's a term that was, I mean, that I would very much associate with Bloch, and especially in his aesthetic writings, he speaks a lot about it. Mahdi Amel in his in the recently or not so recent collection on Arab Marxism, there's also an essay called on Cultural Heritage, and what Amel tries to argue there is that you know, a genuine national liberation movement has to work through the culture that is being practiced, and not only the culture as it is, but like how this culture positions itself in with relationship to past cultures. So he speaks about philosophers who get taken up as these important cultural heroes, but actually their philosophy signifies a failed revolution. You know, there's elements of culture that testify to a forlorn past, but they are invoked in a way that ends up cementing the present rather than breaking through it. And so what he proposes is that their anti-colonial struggles should find those elements within the past which cannot be reconciled with the present, with the colonial condition. So there's also a way to, you know, take up this archive of resistance that you mentioned. And it's communist praxis to mourn, to bring up the past under the light of the present, and to negotiate, you know, which images of the archive keep us in this place, and which ones carried a vision of the future that is irreconcilable with the present. You know, there's a conversation between Bloch and Adorno, and right in the introduction, Adorno says, you know, Ernst Bloch, who has made the word utopia fashionable again, he's done us a service by bringing utopia back. And he said, and immediately in the next sentence, he says, but like, what about all those utopian dreams that have been fulfilled, and like, unfortunately so, by television and so on? And so this is, or like, you know, in like a more classically Marxist archive, you find Engels talking about, you know, barricades, and how barricades were like a progressive tactic, like they helped instill fear and like produce proletarians engaging in street fighting, and but then of course the police forces were able to adapt, and then when an uprising tries to do the same thing again, they lose the street fight, of course. So I mean, this is a more literal example. This is less about dreams, but it's I think there's the same principle of you know, the past being purposefully carried into the present. Like there's not just the communist struggle as it takes place in the now. We cannot distance ourselves from the past. We cannot, I mean, if you will, this is Bloch just saying, you know, you can't do realpolitik in a communist way. You cannot focus on the here and now in a way that cuts off all the loose ends that go into either direction, the past and the future. So this, I mean, to go back to the colonial aspect, this was just very this similarity was very interesting to me.
Well, first, the only thing I managed, because again I take forever to read, but I thought it was really interesting. I enjoyed it so much. It was a male critique of Edward Said. Because when I was reading Orientalism, I was getting a little bit impatient on not ever hearing the issue of class. Because let's not forget that maybe, perhaps, today there's not such a thing as working class, but there's definitely a capitalist class that has a very, very specific agenda. So that one is there, and it has to be, you know, mentioned. And not, you know, abstracted or sidelined, just call something colonialism and, you know, make a sort of fog around the thing. Again, about the whole thing about the future, there was this thing I was taking from a blog, and then I will mention something as well about the open times or temporalities that some crises can bring in relation to the barricades and Engels' critique of it. So I thought it was something really moving, in a sense, where he says it is in the today, in possession of it, also completely tangible in the winning cause itself, its subjective manifestation, its subjective factor. It's not pent-up anger, but rather the class-conscious revolutionary proletarian. Its objective manifestation, its objective factor, is not a perishing remnant, not even an incompleted past, but rather, the impeded future. I thought, my God, you know, that's exactly what's happening to us. There's a future for us that is being impeded, sorry about pronunciation, is aborted for us, is blocked for us, and we have to gain it, we have to sequester it. That's the correlation of forces. About the whole thing about the barricades is quite interesting, because Korsch and Horkheimer, in this text I've been working on, mentioned the example of collectivization in Spain as an event, historical event, that even if end up failing to the hands of fascism, and also to the internal implosion facilitated by Stalin, very particularly psychoagenda, were actually able to demonstrate that certain things, certain resistance, but also putting in practice, were possible. And one of the things that happened that Korsch explains is that the workers were fully armed. So when the crisis started very quickly, because obviously the coup happened, I mean, some small military cadres to sort of take over all the important cities, but probably there's already intelligence going on there, and everybody is smelling something is going to happen. So the workers have gone into, I don't know where exactly what it is, and they pick up a lot of weapons. So they do construct barricades, but they have weapons, you know, they have a whole pretty improvised strategy, but then again, probably recurring to certain lessons from the archive, and put it into practice. But while they're putting this into practice, they go immediately again and in parallel to this, because they do manage to quash the fascists, into the collectivization. So they just go clack, 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 clack. So that crisis opens up a temporality for a condition of possibility, which is very creative, which invents, rehearses, with the elements that he has registered as part of the archive. And this, I thought it was really inspiring because this has happened to me as a, let's say, dancer, you know, pretty much involved in improvisation and composing through improvisation more than writing and directing the whole thing. And also from interacting with other people so that we make, you know, we never were one choreographer and as follow, but we were interacting with each other, improvising and then picking up material. So trial and error, picking up that work, discarding that we were not convinced, and like this, back and forward, back and forward. So for me, it was very easy to visualize this happening, because I just saw these people, they just had all this information, but now in that kind of opening time of absolute crisis, they take over the restaurant, the barber shop, the factory, the lawyer's firm, and they collectivize absolutely everything. But they don't have, like, the A, B, C, D, you know. That first you do this, then you do that, you know. They just start to do it. And the practice in itself makes it. And then, obviously, the possibility of error, mistakes, and, you know, not so well done things gets also given space. And it's like a space, obviously, for learning, which is, I think, we cannot avoid to have. But then thinking on the other side about, the counter-revolution and how it behaves, you can see how they really have all the archive. Like, you know, they have very close together. I mean, they have even studied Deleuze and Guattari, you know. Probably they have read the whole Frankfurt School. And they do study the enemy because they pick up the good ideas as well. They pick up the good ideas, but for their own means. And also, they have the antiquity. You can see that these people don't stop reading Thucydides or Sun Tzu or whoever they have to study. And they do behave like disciplined military people. And this has been, for me, one of the most kind of critical points, no, of what it meant being in the left, no, because when I was traveling in, it's not that I was everywhere in Latin America, I mean, I basically lived in one city in Colombia, in Guatemala, and in Puerto Rico. It's not that I've been everywhere. But especially in Colombia, where I went to give a short lecture in the university, and I could see even reminds of bullets, or the students were showing me, and they were telling me, at this very moment, we have spies from the right wing, but also some people from maybe from the FARC or the EDNL, or I always forget how it's pronounced, NLL, coming to see if they pick us up. So the people going for the younger, the people going to try to capture their imagination was also very active. But when I was there, I was really truly considering and thinking in parallel with what happened at the time with the people from the resistance in Spain, about how far or how less next to the cultural ideological elements, the other side, the most disciplined military thing, etc., etc., had supposed. And perhaps this take us, and I have to confess, I didn't have time to fully read Canafani, but, you know, perhaps also to Che, you know, like all those figures, right, that they sort of like embody a little bit of everything, no?
Yeah. And there is something that I think there's not just these sort of parallels between Bloch and authors we mentioned who responded to the colonial situation. You also told me you were very attentive to something that Bloch invoked about the Mohammedans.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes. Do you got handy the citation about he compares them as, yeah, can you?
Revolutions against civilization in this demonic form were previously known only in the Orient, above all in the Mohammedan world. Their fanaticism still benefits only the white guard in our country as well, and will continue to do this as long as the revolution does not occupy and rebaptize the living yesterday. I really love the expression to occupy and rebaptize the living yesterday, because he just highlights that the yesterday is not something dead, something sleeping. It's precisely something that weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living. It does something. It pushes. It shows up. It's not only constructed or reconstructed. But yeah, he talks about revolutions against civilization carried out in the Mohammedan world, which is a very particular example that he chooses there.
But also because it appears that, you know, very soon, and he says National Socialism has shown enough proletarianized people in demonized form, their ridiculously horrible image must not be forgotten, let alone unused. That one I found really cryptic. It's like, what does he mean? Sometimes I do get a little bit kind of confused. But is it time to say the Nazis were demonizing the proletarians, or the proletarianized aspect of the Fordist element of Nazism wasn't there, you know? Because that's another aspect as well, the Fordist aspect.
I think what he means in that sentence is that, you know, regardless of a possible demise of Hitler, as he says a sentence before that, we now live in a world where we have been able to see the violence unleashed by the reactionary response to proletarianization. It's a frightening image that ought not to be forgotten, much less go unused. So on the one hand, he's saying that we cannot reconcile ourselves, we should not reconcile ourselves with a present that, you know, that erects itself as a substitution for that past. Like, no, like the present carries this past, and it is also our responsibility to well, not only to talk about it, but to fight it as something that lingers, right? I mean, this the same way Adorno says in the essay about working through the past, that he is not as afraid of the, you know, manifest national socialism that's, you know, visible and explicit. What frightens him more is the fascism that survives, protected by the institutions of bourgeois democracy. And I think this is the way we need to read this part. No poetry after Auschwitz. Like, it's a frightening image that ought not to be forgotten. It's, in a way, this is Bloch's own version of the categorical imperative to not allow this to happen again, and to not shy away from analyzing it, because there's, you know, the past is not truly dead. So there's, I mean, this is also like the Blochian argument for the survival of fascism in democracy, that, you know, there's nothing that a capitalist present, a capitalist now, can do to safeguard itself against the possible invocation of these different temporalities for the cause of fascism. Because, and he says this very clearly towards the end, you know, there's a task for the revolution to, he says, remain exclusively one involving the contradictions set by late capitalism, not the ruptures it sets free, which the Hitler movement exploits. Precisely this proletarian hegemony in the overdue triple alliance cannot be managed, especially if the hegemony is to be undiluted and secure, unless dialectics also thoroughly masters the material of genuine non-synchronism and its heterogeneous contradictions. So he speaks about the triple alliance between the proletariat and the immiserated peasants and the immiserated middle class. He sees, you know, or like we mentioned before, like he says, the middle classes also want to, like, they would be content with returning to the drawing board, and there's a possibility still for the proletarian masses to be disappointed in fascism. And so I think this how he talks about disappointment is very interesting, because it usually, this argument gets constructed against the left, you know, like the left has failed to reach the proletarian masses, and they are disappointed by the left, and so it it exclusively becomes like this, you know, there's a like the like disappointment can only mean a turn towards the reactionary, a turn towards fascism. And I think something that he takes up is also that whoever the proletarians align themselves with, this does not need to be stable and everlasting, because there's a you know, those temporalities persist. This non-synchronous character, and so, or he says, the task is to extrapolate the elements of the non-synchronous contradiction, which are capable of antipathy and transformation, those hostile to capitalism, to refit them to function in a different context. So it's about, you know, exploiting the non-synchronous contradiction to turn it against the present.
Yeah, I think what I understood, at least in that moment where he's talking about the fascist deception, it is denied this time, denied and passed it over from the vulgar masses' side for long enough. Fascism exploited that which is still in the way of peasant and petit bourgeois opposition, and of non-contemporaneous opposition in general. There does arises in order that the non-contemporaneous element can be mastered, the problem of a multi-layer revolutionary dialectic, for obviously the entirety of early development is not yet resolved in capitalism and its dialectic world history, as the bourgeois revolutionary born already say, is a house which has more staircases than rooms. And Marx himself, when he stresses the relatively more tolerable aspect of the pre-capitalist situation, and even describes Greek art and epic poetry in certain respects as a norm, then in his word, the social childhood of humanity is a hardly relaxed stimulus, and capitalism, at any rate, not the only house of history which is to be dialectically inherited. But in general, what I did find in his moment, which I, at the moment, struggle because I highlighted absolutely everything which it would be impossible to talk about. But I did got from him was definitely that he was a slightly, yes, criticizing that there was something about a mechanicist aspect in Marxism that sort of like dismissed or looked down into maybe utopia, maybe certain aspect of promoting ideology or adhering to certain elements, especially when he depicts the more chaos, you know, the formless, pent-up anger moment where you just like weep yourself about the whole the now that is oppressing you, and then how a narrative comes and captures you very easily, and then out there it appears that there's a narrative that doesn't have time or space to come and capture those who are not already on the side, or ready to understand. So that it doesn't have any patience for people who have had out, or I'm not sure, you know, because they would be considered, I don't know, traitors or something. I think this is precisely what is shown in Korsh essay as well. I mean, it translates as well as the infight, which I do understand they are also very much defending this short essay on solidarity, I think, by Horkheimer, where he says that friends with friends fight just because of an idea. But it has another edge to it, in which that possibility of that passion, that be passion, that the other one is mistaken perhaps, so that has been like a misunderstanding or something at work, or that maybe even if you don't fully agree, you could cooperate for the time being for the sake of, you know, certain things that have to be achieved, and otherwise you will not be able. So I was not able now to find the moment, but it does, in this essay, include a certain critique of why he thought there was a key issue in Marxism's moment of failure. And self-reflection and self-critique is obviously is very important. So that's one of the things I definitely am interested as well. And I think that takes me to your, like, I really enjoy your paper for CRMP, and you mentioned a few things related, that sort of blocking spirit, Russian, but they bring something that is very new. And also it connects perhaps with this idea of how we deal with mourning, because obviously the unpeed future brings us a mourning in the present, because if our future is aborted for us, it's not let it happen by certain forces who are asphyxiating us, right? That's one sort of mourning. The mourning that I experienced when I was much younger, because I was in the company of older people who had been part of all the revolts of the May 68, who had been in prison, who were, had occupied their universities where they had been journals. So I met people who then were like in their 30s, and I was like in sort of like 18, 19. And they were telling me all these things. Oh, you could see. But you could see already the melancholia creeping in. And obviously you could see, in a sense, the self-medication to that melancholia that the 80s supposed for certain left, which could go straight to the St. Vitus dance, as let's all meet in Studio 54, and have lots of coke, you know, and forget about everything because we lost everything. And now we're supposed to, you know, the end of history and whatever, whatever, so there's nothing we can do anymore. No.
I mean, I think Douglas Crimp, for example, he's very important to my research. Douglas Crimp's essay, Mourning and Militancy, he finds himself in a movement which does not want to, or is very uncomfortable. He quotes some figures at reckoning with death. He perceives a general comfort in just, you know, going on and seeing death. And the psychical responses, the more inward responses to it, as a distraction from organizing. And he intervenes and he says, you know, we cannot just leave that to the past. Like, we carry the wounds of the past. Like, we are the bearers of the living yesterday. And so it is also a responsibility just on the front of like organizing political groups to also use moments of loss, moments of defeat, not only as a, you know, or as Canafani says, like we should resist this inward turn, this melancholic inward turn that lashes out aggressively we have to eingedenken.
I will cite you. So you said, for every past defeat, there's a memory, a surviving archive of resistance that points to moments in the past whose full picture we will only receive from the standpoint of redemption. Also, mourning, therefore, has to look forward as much as backwards, or else it risks collapsing into the social democratic optimism of progress or the fatalism of understanding lost to be transcendental and our work to be infinite. Any analytical account of Marxism which denounces its poetry of redemption and resurrection fails to recognize the proletariat solidarity with its forebears. I was, I am, I shall be, calls us on us to be witnesses engaged in the hard labor of mourning. Bravo. I have to say, I congratulate you for that. I fully agree. And I think it really goes in the spirit of what Bloch is trying to say, but also what Gillian Rose, that I know we both really like, also tries to pass on her expoundings of what is mourning, what is melancholy, is the broken middle, an uncompletely mourning process, and so on. And in that tone, my last question will be the issue of Hamlet and his mourning. So, what do you think? Is he mourning? The time is out of young. Is he mourning as a proto-prince, new man of Machiavelli? So he will be, so as a young prince, is conscious that he's surrounded by intrigue and corruption, but will that make of him the new prince a dictator? Or no, or a communist. Or will he open up into that future and will say, I'm going to be the first royal who's also a communist?
Well, you know, art can very much, like works of art can very much betray the class position of their producers. And I think it's also beautiful to end on a somewhat speculative moment. And I just want to say thank you for our listeners. Thank you for tuning in again. And please check out our other episodes on Patreon, Critique of the Podcast Form. The last episodes we released were on the anime question and on Lukács, legality and illegality. And thank you for tuning in to the 10th episode. If you have some coins to spare, feel free to contribute to our Patreon. You will find us on Instagram and on X and every other platforms of critical theory. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Talk to you soon.
That was great. Thank you.